Robin left Berkeley with 2 degrees, moves to Boston in July of 1955, and until then, Blazer was happy to let Duncan and Spicer write his poems. Yeah. Right? Which is just, I mean, to read something like that is kind of trippy to read that.
Yeah.
So moving to Boston was about finding his own ground as a poet.
Oh, I think so. I really think so. He was up against, I think that that story needs to be tied to his early disappointment just out of high school.
At Northwestern University.
Northwestern, yeah, where he burned his poems. You know, he was a sensitive young man. And I guess he had always been told, and all his life experience told him, that he was pretty good, pretty hot stuff. So when somebody says, well, you plagiarized this, and, you know, this sounds like Whitman, and, you know, he was devastated. So his successes in high school were mostly dramatic. He goes to Berkeley, and it's not really, he's not there to be a poet, but he meets two very, very, sort of assertive poets, especially Duncan, I think, was assertive. He said, Spicer maybe not so much, but Spicer had the air, you know, he could pull it off. And Robin, no, he was not a sort of top dog in Berkeley at all. He was he didn't call himself a poet even. He was the one that they all read their poems to. So Boston, and he, oh boy, some of the letters, you know, that went back and forth between Duncan and Robin and Spicer and Robin in Boston tell you that he really, when one of them would write a good poem, it would lay him out for weeks. It wasn't because he didn't admire them and like them. He liked them too much. It was that he thought he could never do that, you know? So he had to really struggle through with that. He wrote a lot of stuff in Boston, most of which hasn't been published. The Boston poems don't cover that. What don't really cover the output that he was able to achieve in Boston. He was interested in surrealism, and that comes through in the early Boston poems. I think, interestingly, there's a link to Catholicism there, because it is the strange inside the familiar that he liked in surrealism. If I read him rightly, he liked that the ordinary, the strange, had this dimension to it, had this completely unexpected strangeness, this otherness to it. Mm-hmm. So he was working on that.
And the occult. Those two things
were
sort of main tools in the bag for him at that time.
Yeah, and they're related, because the strange and the familiar is a transmutation of the occult. Like, the occult is quite anthropocentric. You know, the gods and goddesses look like us. They're creatures like us, and they can do more things than we can do. But heck, you know, they're still very human centered. And I think what he did in Boston is to take that away. That it's going to be much stranger. A deanthropomorphized occult is much scarier. It's much stranger, much closer to surrealism, that where something comes up from the dark and you really don't know what it is, mm-hmm. right? Than the projection outward of the human form in various, cosmic relationships and mm-hmm. proportions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he was working on that in Boston. And then he comes back to San Francisco, right, 1960, and right away it's Cups, the Park, the Fairy Queen, the Moth Poem, Les Chimères, Image Nations, 1-4. It's 1, 2, bang, 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 bang. Mm-hmm. They all come out mm-hmm. within 5 years.
He's quite busy. And in Boston, he's trying to figure out what lies beyond or beneath rational, ego-centered consciousness.
Yeah.
Is how you put it.
Yeah.
And part of that is writing spontaneously. The word dictation is often used when discussing Blazer and Spicer. That's said to engage the decentered self, or self as capital O other.
Yeah.
So something inside me has known this for a long time, and I've not been able to articulate that.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking of a writer's critique circle where somebody looks at my poem written spontaneously and says that it has some kind of godlike narrator voice. And it's like, I sure as hell ain't going for that, but that's what comes out.
Yeah.
So how do we engage the self as other? I mean, and I'm thinking as appropriate for these times in which we live, right?
Yeah.
How perfect is that? And yet projection or the practice of outside or organic poetry, however you want to say it, certainly out of favor, has yeah. been. So why dictation? Why spontaneity as a way to get into what's underneath the ego-centered consciousness and into that decentered self, or self as capital O other?
Well, first I have to say that Robin doesn't claim dictation for himself. And he does say that explicitly in the Sam Tuitt interview. He's asked about dictation. He said, well, that's Spicer, right? And to get to that point, I think that was partly wrapped up in Spicer's alcoholism. Lou Ellingham told me, because he'd been down that road himself, I think, that there's a certain point in the morning, about 5 a.m., he said, for an alcoholic, where everything gets clear for a little while, you know, and that you drink to get to that point. I can't speak to that. You know, that I just simply thought it was a striking description where the listening, the self that is always wanting to edit and to make sense of things and so on is somehow quieted for a while and something else comes out. But for Robin, I think it's a little different. It's more about polarity. It's more about relationship with the other, right? So the other is the unthought. It's what you don't know. It's what you don't own. And there's always, when you put yourself in relationship with that, it helps to situate you, not so much in, I don't know, the whatever goes on in the unconscious. It situates you in the world in a way where your voice has to be always in tension with something that it doesn't know. Yeah, I think that's the best way to think about it. You know, it's not as if that other thing can speak itself, because then it wouldn't be other, would it?
Mm-hmm.
But it's you need to address it in a sense,
mm-hmm.
right? You need to put yourself in tension with it,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise everything just lands on the ego, on the self, you know, on the speaking self. So I mean, polarity was Robin's answer to deconstruction, right? Because it's an experiential issue, that deconstruction. Experience had already been critiqued in the criticism of phenomenology that was coming out in their language-centered philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Experience was something that you couldn't have anymore, because after all, what was experience? Experience was your language, your social position, your psychology, all these things that you didn't have conscious awareness of, right? But I think for Robin, the thing is that we all still do, no matter what, how we try to work it through a reflexive awareness, we still live inside experience. So how do you articulate that without making it seem like your take on reality is the only thing that is, without, let's say, taking on the capital P poet,
mm-hmm.
because actually you're just a little guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to climb up into the great big seat of the poet. Anyway.
I was going to say the beanstalk.
Yeah, the beanstalk. Yeah, really. So, So you have to get, for Robin, it was the unthought, you know. This is my voice, which is small and finite and very situated in time, space, context. And you can put all the adjectives in there that you like, race and class and gender and sexuality and whatever. It's all situated there, but it's also, how do I act that out? Well, I act it out in relationship to another that I haven't thought or mastered. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which seems to me that noetic, again, is a key, yeah, is a key component.
Yeah.
John Wieners, Steve Jonas, drugs, Bohemia,
yeah,
Denise Levertov, with whom he never really gelled, and who had a nasty word for him in a letter to Duncan, which I'd forgotten,
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
That's the scene in Boston, but
yes,
not far from there in Gloucester's Charles Olson, the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead. There's the Violets essay,
yes,
which was not published in a poetry journal, but in a journal of process studies in Claremont, California.
Yeah.
And so the Violets is worth discussing, but also this criticism from Charles Olson that Robin Blazer's work lacks syntax.
Yeah, I trust you anywhere with image, but you've got no syntax.
So, what did he mean?
Well,
what do you think?
It's a toughie to figure out what Olson meant there. What I would imagine he meant was that Blazer hadn't at that stage, because this is early Boston, and it was in relation to some unpublished poems, still unpublished poems, that Robin had sent him, that he hadn't put himself, he hadn't positioned himself in the poem, right? So the subject was missing. The subject was missing. And Robin replied to that, oh, you're right, you know. You can't, in other words, you can't just cross the I out of every sentence and think that you've erased the ego.
Right.
That doesn't work. Then you just have an incomplete sentence. Right? What you have to do is then figure out how to situate the I in its context so that then you have a syntax. So I think that's what, you know, he may have meant. Robin took that comment very seriously. He's worried it and he's, you know, worked it over for years. It finally shows up in Syntax, the title of that whole series, right, mm-hmm, where it's in a poem. He quotes that comment of Olson's. And by that time, syntax for him was very much parataxis. It meant being in the midst of this whole range of various voices that were coming at him from everywhere, from the radio, from his readings, some living, some dead, other poets,
scribbled on the bathroom wall.
Yeah, on the bathroom wall, graffiti.
Right.
Absolutely, everywhere. You know, it was what he was inside of, the syntax that was everywhere. So I think that was the ultimate answer that he came up with to Olson. I think in terms of, I guess I have to speak as more as a reader of Olson and Robin as opposed to trying to imagine what Olson might have meant. But I think for Olson in the Maximus, the character of Maximus, it's just honesty to say, to speak from that position, right? But what Robin, a lot of people have heard that as arrogance on Olson's part. I, Maximus, I'm a big guy, and my voice matters more than yours, right? I don't think Olson ever meant that. I just simply can't see it in the poetry. But I think what Robin felt it necessary to perform that Olson maybe didn't was his voice among a lot of others. And you could say, well, you know, is that true? It's true to a certain extent, because if you look at the Maxis, there are voices everywhere. There's quotation everywhere. I mean, he's pulling all this stuff, right? So in that way, there's a real similarity, and Robin acknowledges his debt to Olsen. But at the same time, Olsen has this persona where Maximus moves, it's Maximus' eyes that we see these other voices through. With Robin, it's more like, well, you know, here I am at the party, and here's somebody else, right? There's Angamon, and there's, you know.
And you should see what I read in the bathroom.
Yeah, you should see what I read in the bathroom. Exactly.
As I think about what you just said, and I think about Olsen and William Carlos Williams and Ezra Pound working out of an ethos that gives us the epic poem.
Yeah.
We have with Blazer and Duncan and Spicer, and then others since then, George Bowring, Daphne Marlett, Nate Mackey, the serial poem.
Yeah.
So tell me how far off I am with the epic is masculinist and the serial isn't.
That's a tough one for me. I just don't know how to answer that. I mean, I know that there's a lot of criticism floating around out there about the epic hero and the hero's journey and focusing on the male figure who goes out and comes back, which is essentially the epic form, right?
Saves the damsel in distress.
Yes, I go out and I come back. That's the basic master narrative of Western Civ. Huh? I do things out there. I may be successful in that case. That's a good trip. Or I may fall on my face and then we have a tragedy. You know, but I fight monsters, or I rescue golden fleece, or I do something out there, and then I go back home with my booty or whatever. Yeah. So that kind of, you know,
narrative
line has been masculinist, I think, for long enough so that we can kind of associate it with that gender. But the serial poem, you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you do go out because all of us do, because we're caught, we're temporal creatures. We go day by day by day, you know. So you're moving all the time, whether you particularly want to or not. But if you stick with the context, then you have to move. The seriality is inevitable, right? You can't, because you're not abstracting from the situation in which you find yourself. That situation is always shifting, and you don't know where it's going to end up. You don't know where you're going. Is that more feminine? I don't know.
Yeah. It's not masculinist.
And
it seems in contrast
yeah.
to the epic, it seems a lot less than that. It seems a lot more fitting for the situation we have now.
Yeah, where it's tough to defend that typical heroic trajectory. Unless, of course, you're a fan of Red Sonja, as I am. So,